Okay, hi everyone. Thanks for being here. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Am I centered in the... That's what I thought. There we go. Better. Yeah, let us continue with Nichiren's Gosho. That last one was The Gift of Rice, which was pretty intense. Information on our practice. Really, I've marked certain Goshos because of their relationship to the Daimoku itself, which I think, as Nichiren practitioners of Lotus Sutra, we often wonder about the different aspects of each character of Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, and that's one that really focuses on Namu. So in that way, I think it's quite important. Now, this one, this scholarship, this is going to give us a lot of insight into the doctrines of Buddhism that you and I often, are often discussed in scholarship, but we, if ever, get the chance to peer into the history, the documents of history of the transfer of teachings and sutras and translations and all that, you might say, behind the scenes, if you will, documentation. So there are letters like this one, which we're about to read, which I won't get through in one sitting. The bodies and minds of ordinary beings. Although the title would seem to indicate to us a status of sorts of what this instantiation, that's manifest body, its purpose, its uses with regard to Buddhist practice. Certainly that will be covered in this letter. But in providing context for that, as is typical of Nichiren, we will get exposed to a ton of the migrations and developments throughout the former, middle, and latter day of the spread, the propagation of Shakyamuni's sutras, how the nature of the cultural biases that have gotten in the way and then been filtered out again from India to China, from northern China to southern China, from China to Korea to Japan, to from India to Sri Lanka and Burma and so forth. and the timing of things. I think I referenced a book a long time ago by, I think, a Nichiren Shu publication. Not temple publication, but one of the principles called, I think it's just called Sutras. And it documents the travails of scholars trying to traverse the Himalayas on pathways scarcely wider than a foothold to get from one part of the continent to the other across Asia. The tremendous difficulties, in other words, of going, learning about certain sutras, and then bringing them back for translation, etc. And given the nature of, you know, no railways, no airplanes, no internet, obviously, no cellular communication, just this person-to-person effort. Some sutras, as they, you know, India's massive continent, and as certain translations or memorizations of sutras traveled through that country, different paths through the lower Himalayas or around the Himalayas through the water, the northern path through what is now like Nepal, different sutras at different times showed up in China, and which meant that sometimes earlier teachings arrived in China hundreds of years after latter teachings. So it kind of screwed up the order of the teachings, right? And so you'd have these spreads throughout the country of different aspects of Buddhism that didn't necessarily jive with one another, and vying for which was more correct than the other. So you can see that not only are there cultural biases from nation to nation, cultures to culture, but subcultures and timing had a lot to do with how Shakyamuni's teachings were promulgated. And now, of course, in the latter day, we have the distinct advantage, in a way, of having a larger overview of all of this drama, and seeing more clearly, once all the evidence is in, just as Tendai did in China, of putting things in proper order, so much so that it became obvious where certain writings were kind of thrown in from people who were trying to fill in the gaps for themselves and weren't really truly or actually the words of Shakyamuni or the translations of the scholars of Shakyamuni's day and the centuries immediately following his passing. So the scholarship was being kind of glommed onto and modified. And so Tendai's job, Chi Che, huge job, and with help from his students, was able to challenge other scholars from the north and the south to decipher which were authentic Shakyamuni teachings and which were erroneous and added upon, so that he could eschew those non-authentic teachings. Anyway, Nichiren will talk about that quite a bit in this history, and it's valuable just to understand the nature of the clarity of Shakyamuni's teachings and how so much effort has been made in the thousands of years since he was alive to preserve the scholarship, the truth, the clarity of his teachings. So here we go. Sorry, my throat's bothering me a bit today. And I'm also being plagued by a couple of toothaches. I don't have insurance. I'm just me. So dental expenses are a little hard to come up with. So you end up suffering. I know that's not uncommon for a lot of us, right? So be careful with your teeth. The bodies and minds of ordinary beings. The sutras preached before the Lotus Sutra deal with the bodies and minds of ordinary beings. You've heard me say that before. And Nichiren will build to that point once again, that the earlier teachings were to the people's capacity, right? The Buddha preached them in terms that would be accessible to the minds of ordinary people. Ordinary being people who are not studied on the Buddhist scholarship, the Buddhist teachings. If you're not practicing Buddhism, then you're samsaric. You're just a samsaric being. That's the reference of ordinary here. And therefore, though they represent the sermons of the Buddha, they do not go beyond the scope of the minds of ordinary people. He was teaching to their capacity and their level of understanding, right? Hence, they are called the sutras that were preached in accordance with the minds of others. To illustrate, suppose that there are parents who do not care for sake themselves, but who have a beloved son who is extremely fond of it. Feeling tenderly toward their son and desiring to win his affection, they urge him to have some sake, and in so doing pretend that they themselves like it too. The foolish son, not knowing any better, thereupon concludes that his father and mother, in fact, like sake. The Trapusha Sutra deals with the realms of human and heavenly beings. Now, there's none, I think I read that the Trapusha Sutra has no remaining artifacts anywhere. So we only know of it through writings of this nature by other scholars, but we don't have actual text or translations or transcriptions of those sutras. So we'll just go with the category Nichiren puts them into here. These sutras, the Trapusha Sutra, deals with the realms of human and heavenly beings. The Agama Sutras deal with the persons of the two vehicles, learning and realization, right? Shravakas and Pratyekabuddhas. The Flower Garland Sutra deals with bodhisattvas. So that's one thing that I've said about the flower garland or the Avatamsaka, the initial, or in Japanese, Kigan Sutra, that that Shakyamuni taught immediately following his own enlightenment. And his description of what the experience of enlightenment was like was very much a bodhisattva experience, because to experience Buddha in human form is to be a fully enlightened bodhisattva, right? But as you might expect, teaching people who'd never heard of Buddha before, Buddha mind, Buddha eye, Buddha life condition before, to hear all these descriptions of what it was like to realize it was well beyond their capacity to understand. So it only took a couple of weeks for Shakyamuni to back off of that and reconsider who he was teaching to. This is again why all of these teachings are considered teachings to the people's capacity, until in the latter years of his life, before it came to a close, he then returned to teach to his own mind what enlightenment, what it is to actually, the method to open that door of enlightenment, not simply to experience it, but how to get to it. That is the Lotus Sutra. Again, I apologize. I think I'll have to get something to drink here in a minute. The Correct and Equal and the Wisdom Sutras in some respect resemble the Agama and Trapusha Sutras, and in others, the Flower Garland Sutra. When ordinary people in this latter age read these various sutras, they suppose that these sutras accord with the mind of the Buddha. But if we ponder the matter closely, we'll see that, in fact, what they are reading is only a reflection of their own minds. Like the son who thinks that his parents, like sake, misunderstands that they're only providing that experience for him. And since their own minds are naturally uncultivated, there is little merit to be gained thereby. Another statement of Lotus Sutra being the only effective method for awakening Buddhahood in this latter age. All previous teachings have very little, if any, effect on our life condition today. Doesn't mean they're meaningless. It means their value in getting us to our Buddhahood is only by reference. If we need to expand our understanding of life, then reading the earlier teachings might provide us some insights that would then help us understand more profoundly the Lotus Sutra. But those earlier teachings, the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, this is getting really annoying now. The Wisdom Sutras, the Diamond Sutras, the Lankavatara, the Vimalakirti, the Hinayana teachings, all of them, they're interesting to round out our earthly understanding of the Buddhist practice, but they are only in service to the Lotus Sutra. Only Myoho Renge Kyo has the profound capability to open our Buddha mind. You can practice those others your whole life long, and you may gain insights into how to conduct your life and how to understand how your mind works, but that won't get you to your Buddha nature, your Buddha life condition, right? The Lotus Sutra, on the other hand, is known as a sutra that was preached in accordance with the Buddha's own mind. Because the Buddha's mind is an excellent mind, an awakened mind, persons who read this sutra, even though they may not understand its meaning, will gain inestimable benefit. So that's almost a controversial thing to say. But in fact, what Nichiren is saying is if you, you may have read all of these other sutras or some of them, as I have. I've read many other sutras and commentaries, both within the Buddhist order and canon and outside with academic scholarship. And I've had tremendous insights, and it's helped me to more profoundly understand the Lotus Sutra, which I go back and reread, and I'm excited by the new insights that I have into the Lotus Sutra. That's my own path. But make no mistake, I practice the method of Myoho Renge Kyo, not any of these other methods, with the hope of awakening my Buddha mind. I only research my own samsaric mind to remove doubt, remove suspicion, remove gaps in understanding, in resolve. And that's what study ultimately is for, is to create a strong resolve. Because as much as we chant Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, and it is the method toward enlightenment, doubts erode our conviction. And so without conviction, as Nichiren constantly reminds us, chanting can become an empty practice. And that's the last thing I want. If I'm going to do this thing, I want it to have full value. I want it to work, right? Don't you? Of course. So whatever you need to do as far as study to up your conviction, by all means do it. Whether it's downloading podcasts, watching these videos, or running around looking for books like on these sutras and read them for yourself, for your own conviction, then do it. Do whatever it takes to get your resolve up to par, without doubt. Mugwort that grows in the midst of hemp, or a snake inside a tube, will, as a matter of course, become straight. And those who associate with good people of good character will consequently become upright in heart, deed, and word. Heart in Asia is always a component of mind, right? It's thought. How do you think? Attitude, intent. That's all associated with heart in Asia. Not so in the West. Probably should be, but you should at least see it that way. When we talk about heart in Buddhist writings, we're talking about heart, mind, mind, attitude, intent. Okay? So heart, deed, and word. So thought, word, action, right? The Lotus Sutra exerts a similar influence. The Buddha will look upon one who simply puts resolute mind, there it is, and conviction in this sutra as a good person. So there you have a definition of a good person, right? And that's the kind of influence you want. Concerning the Lotus Sutra, however, the form of its teaching will vary depending upon the people's capacity, the time, the country, and the individuals who propagate it. Right? Cultural bias. Yet it seems that even bodhisattvas who have reached a stage of near perfect enlightenment do not understand these relationships. How much less can ordinary people in the latter age even fathom them? In general, there are three kinds of messengers. The first kind is extremely clever. The second is not particularly clever, but is not foolish either. And the third is extremely foolish, but nevertheless reliable. So by clever, again, we're dealing with cultural bias. Who translated this word into clever? In the West, I think clever, certainly throughout my life, has always sort of indicated somebody who was maybe less than honest or understood workarounds, somebody who didn't necessarily walk a straight path but knew how to negotiate it. There's an aspect of the word clever that says there might be a slight manipulation or deception in there. Now, that's not how it's meant here. This is meant in a truly older way of clever being just smart. A good intellectual is clever because he knows how to put things together with perspicacity, with clear insights, and how to communicate those clear insights. That's the older meaning of clever, and that's the clever that we're using here, right? Not somebody who can wink, wink, get you along. You see the difference? So, in general, there are three kinds of messenger. The first kind is extremely clever, extremely insightful and clear and precise. That's what he means. The second is not particularly that precise and clear and insightful, but he's also not foolish. He's not somebody who'll just add his own flavor to things. He may not have the vocabulary or the precision that the first messenger has, but he's also not going to mislead you. He's just trying hard, or she is just trying hard. The third is extremely foolish, but nevertheless reliable. He doesn't know how all of this works to precision. He just has a high degree of confidence and stays with the program, so he's reliable, right? Of these three types, the first will commit no error transmitting the message. The second, being somewhat clever, but not quite as clever as the first type, will add his own words to his Lord's message. So I was slightly incorrect in my definition there. There is some foolishness in there. I don't know why he said clever but is not foolish, because now he's saying clever, but not as clever as the first, but add his own words to this Lord's message. So maybe in his desire or her desire to be convincing, she makes the error of adding her own flourishes to things to explain things the way she understands them or he understands them, right? And that's not reliable. Thus, he is the worst possible type of messenger. The third type, being extremely foolish, will not presume to insert his own words, and being honest, will relay his Lord's message without deviating from it, even though he or she may not understand it. But they will honor it word for word. Thus, he is a better messenger than the second type, and occasionally may even be better than the first. Because that third messenger stumbling through repeating the exact message as he remembers it is giving you the opportunity to get insight from it in your own mind. And in some cases, that's the greatest value, because the very clever messenger, the first type, might put so much precision and verbiage around what he's saying that you start to go a little dull from it. You don't perceive it. You don't know. You don't think that you can measure up even to the knowledge he has. And that can create doubt. See, there's all these human foibles in here, right? The first type of messenger may be likened to the four ranks of sages in India. The second type corresponds to the teachers in China. And the third type may be likened to the ignorant but honest persons among the ordinary people of this latter age. So that's an interesting supposition, basically saying that people who are not aware of Buddhism or the proper order of teaching or the ultimate teaching of Myoho Rengekyo, who are just curious about Buddhism, they may not understand how it works or know how it works, but they have the capacity, because of our time in this modern age, we have the capacity to at least understand that if we apply ourselves honestly with conviction to anything we want to do, we can accomplish it. See, that's a very modern kind of thinking. And this is what Nichiren is identifying here. Once again, putting substance behind studying the Lotus Sutra, practicing Myoho Rengekyo, without necessarily understanding the tower of meaning and experiential teachings, the expedient means, because we have the capacity to understand with conviction Myoho Rengekyo, we can accomplish and enlighten our minds with our Buddha nature, even without fully understanding it. That's quite something. But conversely, practicing the other teachings as though they would bring us to enlightenment is a great fallacy, because those teachings are preparatory. They don't get us to the invocation. They don't get us to the manifestation of our Buddha. They just train our samsaric, ordinary minds. Do you see? I will set aside here the period when the Buddha lived in this world. The period of 1,000 years that followed from the day after his passing is known as the former day of the law. This 1,000-year period of the former day is divided into two. During the first 500 years, the teaching of the Hinayana Sutras spread. Those are the early teachings, right? The persons who propagated them were Mahakashyapa, Ananda, and others. And in the second 500 years, Ashvaghosha, Nagarjuna, Asanga, Vasubandhu, and others spread the teachings of the provisional Mahayana Sutras. Some among these scholars wrote about parts of the Lotus Sutra, and others made no mention of it whatsoever. Of the scholars who appeared after this 1,000-year period of the former day, their views in a few cases resembled the Buddha's own teaching, but for the most part, they fell into error. Of those who appeared in the former day and were not in error, but whose treatises were incomplete, we may name Mahakashyapa, Ananda, Ashvaghosha, Nagarjuna, Asanga, and Vasubandhu. Where are we? In the 1,000-year period of the middle day of the law, Buddhism was introduced to China. But at first, because of controversy with the Confucians, there was apparently no time to delve into the internal divisions of Buddhism, such as the distinction between Mahayana and Hinayana, and between provisional and true teachings. As the Buddhist teachings spread more widely and one doctrine after another was introduced from India, some persons who had earlier seemed discerning now appeared in the light of more recent introduced sutras and treatises to have been foolish. There were also some who had earlier been thought foolish, but who were now seen to have been wise. In the end, 10 different schools developed, and 1,000 or 10,000 different interpretations were propounded. Ignorant people did not know which to adhere to, while the attachment to their own views of those thought to be wise was extreme. So, you had the full range of misunderstandings and mindless following, fanaticism. In the end, however, there was one opinion that all agreed upon. It was, in short, that all of the teachings set forth in the course of the Buddha's lifetime, the Flower Garland Sutra ranked first, the Nirvana Sutra second, and the Lotus Sutra third. Oops. No one from the ruler on down to the common people disputed this interpretation because it was shared by the Dharma teacher Fao Yun, the Dharma teacher Chi Tsang, and the other leaders of the 10 schools, who were all looked upon as great sages. Then, in the time of Chen and Sui dynasties, during the middle day of the law, there appeared a young monk named Chi Yi, who was later to be known as the great teacher Tendai Chiche. Although he taught many doctrines, his teachings ultimately centered upon this single issue of the relative superiority of the Lotus, Nirvana, and Flower Garland Sutras. The Dharma teacher Chi Yi declared that the teachers of Buddhism had these three works ranked upside down. The ruler of the Chen dynasty, in order to determine the truth of the matter, thereupon summoned a group of more than 100 men, including the administrator of monks, Hui Heng, the supervisor of monks, Hui Quang, the Dharma teacher, Hui Zheng, and the Dharma teacher, Fa Sui, all among the most eminent leaders of the 10 schools of the North and South, and had them confront Chi Yi in debate. We're going to get to the bottom of this. The Dharma teacher Chi Yi said, quote, "The Lotus Sutra itself says, quote, among the sutras it holds the highest place. It also says, among the sutras I, Shakyamuni, have preached, now preach, and will preach, this Lotus Sutra is the most difficult to take confidence in and the most difficult to understand. The Immeasurable Meaning Sutra makes clear that the sutras that Buddha already has preached here refers to the teaching of great wisdom and the flower garland teaching of the ocean imprint meditation, and so forth. And with regard to the sutras he will preach, the Nirvana Sutra says, so on and so forth, from the Prajnaparamita, the teachings on the perfection of wisdom, he brought forth the Nirvana Sutra. These scriptural passages show that the Lotus Sutra is superior to the Flower Garland and Nirvana Sutras. They make it abundantly clear, clear as could possibly be. You should understand accordingly. Rebuked in this manner, some of his opponents simply shut their mouths. Others spewed out abuse, you little blah, 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 blah. While still others turned pale. Oh, I screwed up, right? The Chen ruler then rose from his seat and bowed 3 times. And all the 100 officials pressed their palms together in reverence. Powerless to prevail, the leaders of the other schools conceded defeat. I'm sure there was a lot more to the proceedings than that, but this is a basic outline, right? Thus it was established that the Lotus Sutra holds the highest place among the teachings of the Buddha's lifetime. Then, during the latter 500 years of the middle day of the law, new translations of the sutras and treatises appeared one after another. In the third year of the Chen Kuang era, 629, in the reign of Emperor Taizong, or Sheng, a monk named Sheng Chuang journeyed to India. He spent 17 years mastering the various Buddhist doctrines of the five regions of India and returned to China in the 19th year of the same era, 645, introduced the Profound Secret Sutra, the treatise on the stages of yoga practice, the treatise on the consciousness-only doctrine, and the other teachings of the Dharma Characteristics School. Sheng Chuang declared, "Although there are many different schools in India, this school is the foremost." Emperor Taizong was one of the worthiest rulers in China, was as known, and he took Sheng Chuang to be his teacher. In essence, what this school teaches is that for some persons, the three vehicles are a mere expedient, and the one vehicle, Lotus Sutra, represents the truth. While for others, the one vehicle is an expedient and the three vehicles represent the truth. It also teaches that the five natures are completely separate and that those sentient beings whose nature predestines them to the two vehicles or who lack the nature of enlightenment can never attain Buddhahood. Such doctrines were as incompatible with those of the Tendai school as are fire and water. But by this time, both the great teacher Tendai Chiche and the great teacher Chang'an had passed on, and their successors were not the men they ought to have been. Hence, it appeared that the Tendai school was already gone down in defeat. Should I pause here? Yeah. It's quite a lot to digest, so let's take a pause there. And now we're after the time of Tendai, so we're in the later middle day, and we'll see what happens from that point on as Nichiren brings us up to date in Japan. So we will start with later during the reign of Empress Wu. This is quite an interesting historicity, if you will, of the documentation and the spread of Buddhism. You have to understand that with so many sermons, so many teachings, that translating all of that or transcribing all of that accurately with, you know, some hundred monks of expertise as a panel to satisfy, to all read through and go, yes, I believe that, right? Yes, would you recite this again? Yes, I think this is how we write this in Sanskrit or Pali. And then we have to take this and disseminate it all over the world, on foot, on horseback, and take it to places. You know, India, picture this. Today, at last count, because it may have changed, I have a good friend, Manohara Yaraheli. I don't know how he's doing. He went back to India. But, and I verified this from different sources, India, as a land, as a country, has over 125 distinct languages. I'm not saying you go from California where people say, "Hey dude, how's it hanging?" and you go to the South and they go, "Hey y'all, what's up?" I'm not talking about dialects. I'm not talking about Cockney slang in England that's a little hard to decipher what they're saying. I'm talking about somebody from your neighborhood goes to a neighborhood some 200 miles away and absolutely cannot communicate. different, completely different languages. Over 125 in one country. It's hard to imagine that. So imagine spreading this teaching throughout India. Forget the rest of the world for a moment. Just the difficulty of communicating any teaching through all of these barriers of language, which inculcate different differences of microcultures, right? That we can understand. We can understand that just simply the act of shopping and cooking food in the South is far different than, well, just look at the argument between Chicago and New York on something as simple as pizza, right? There are different cultural norms in different micro cultures all over the world, and certainly within one country. Imagine with more than 125 distinct languages, how distributing a teaching, which is all words, to elaborate on concepts, which you can only climb at with words, how difficult that was. And then you transpose that into different areas of another large continent, China, where the people of the North have completely different diets and realities than the people of the South. They're like microcultures, right? East and West, Nepal and Shenzhen, Burma, the Javanese, the Indonesians, the Malaysians, Vietnam, Korea, and then finally Japan, and then the rest of Jambudvipa. How many hurdles? So, ultimately, we need to know what the most direct method is to awaken our Buddha nature. That is Myoho Renge Kyo. How we get there is a hugely storied history, right? And all of it is supportive of, because it ultimately leads to it, the teachings of Shakyamuni. How much of each of those translations do you need to understand in order to develop the confidence that you need to invoke your Buddha nature? We're all different that way, right? Some of us, remember the word Icchantika, the incorrigible disbelief? This is a cautionary word. This is a caution to those of us who enjoy research and study so much that we can forget why we're motivated to research and study. We can fall in love with research and study and never apply that knowledge to actual doing, which is Myoho Renge Kyo, thought, word, and deed, all at once. This is why we have a mandala. This is why Nichiren made this mandala. Because he understood, as samsaric beings, we need something to go, hey, over here, over here. When we can lock onto it, then thought, word, and deed all comes very, it's just a nice flow. Right? Okay. Thanks for hanging in there with me. Thanks for participating. Thank you for your support. Oh my goodness. I'm so amazed by your practice. Please continue to increase your confidence. Chant every day. Take care of your health. Without it, we can't chant. And try as best you can to be kind. Sometimes it's hard, I know. But if that's what's in our hearts, I'm sure it will prevail. Just like you. See you in the next one. Namo Myoho Kyo. Hey, thank you for being here. Did you know there's a third way you can help support this channel? And it won't cost you a cent. Yep, if you are not able to be a patron on Patreon or use the PayPal me at .com at Sifu Sylvain because you don't have the financial fortune to help support this channel right now, you, as I say, always support this channel by watching. But you can also help us grow so that maybe one day we can get over 10,000 subscribers and YouTube will grace us with monetization. It's not a lot, but if you can make sure you're subscribed and share a video like a simple one, just go into the search criteria and type monk and you'll have a video that'll come up that's been up for years about what is a monk. You know, it's called monk, who, how, where, something like that. That might be a great introduction to somebody who doesn't understand what a monk is to begin with. It's a tool. Use this channel as a tool to help you with your bodhisattva practice and share a video to somebody who you think, oh, I know somebody who'll benefit from watching this. And in that way, you can help us grow. And that's a really good way to help your practice along as well. So just wanted to drop that in on you in case that's something that you might find useful. Take care of yourself again, and I'll see you soon. Bye.